Welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast. I'm your host, Agnes Knowles. Today's guest became a European Masters weightlifting champion last year at age 60, which really qualifies her to discuss the advantages of being strong, building and maintaining our muscle mass as we go through life, and the wisdom of what she calls intentional eating. She explains how to retrain your brain to reconnect with your muscles. I love that. Oh, one caveat about that weightlifting championship thing last year. Kim was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis, in 2013. Listen now. Every once in a while, you hear a story that makes you stop and say, wow. And that's exactly what a couple of hiking friends said recently when I told them who I was chatting with today. Kim is a former journalist with a doctorate in political science. Like many of us, she made a career change in midlife to a passion career and now promotes, I love this, intentional eating for us midlife women, as well as building and maintaining muscle as we get older to delay, possibly even avoid, many of the health issues too many people think are inevitable. I said passion, and you'll get the picture when I tell you Kim started weight training. And last year, she won a European Masters weightlifting championship at age 60. Are you impressed? Well, how would if I tell you that in 2013, Kim was diagnosed with MS, multiple sclerosis? Kim Rahier, welcome to the Boomer Woman's Podcast.
Well, thank you for having me. It makes it sound so amazing the way you tell the story. Sometimes I really have to sort of pinch myself. Is she really talking about me? But yeah, that's my story.
And as we were just discussing it, your whole story started in 2008, and we're going to get to that. But tell us a little bit about your life pre-2008. You were a journalist. I take it your husband was a journalist. Relocation was sort of the norm.
Yes, we moved every 4 years. We started our married life in Dubai, stayed there for 4 years. At the end of those 4 years, I had my first son. We then moved briefly to Paris, then we moved to Vienna, then we moved back to Paris, then we moved to Berlin. So Paris was his headquarters. So we had to go there once in a while, and then we started and try to move around, to places that we found enjoyable. And over time, we had 3 kids. And we were sort of dragging them around all these places, changing like really like clockwork every 4 years. And he was the one with the steady job and the assignments, and the ready built infrastructure to start working in when we got to new places. And I was a journalist too, but I worked freelance and started from scratch every time we got somewhere. So in a way, that was less comfortable, but I think it was also a little bit more exciting and challenging. And I could discover stuff that he couldn't because of his office duties. And very, very typical when we were in Dubai, we got a chance actually to travel to Saudi Arabia, for example. And I got to talk to Saudi Arabian women, like a doctor, a shop owner, an accountant. And that would have been totally impossible for him. So I had a little bit of a more liberty to do things. But of course, I didn't have the income or the reliable, the steadiness of a job most of the time.
I shouldn't say there's an advantage to that, but if one person does have the steady income, it's a little bit easier then for the other person to go down those little pathways that you were going down and maybe get a story that, would be totally impossible for the other person.
Yes, absolutely. And it's as everything in life, it's a question of how you frame it, right? And I was able to frame it as me having more liberty rather than me not having security and the same income. But there were also times when I felt that I didn't get quite the same recognition, that I was still seen as the wife accompanying the husband and doing some stuff just to sort of spend the time or entertain herself. So there was a bit of that too. But overall, it's really how you frame it will actually define your experience.
Yeah, very, very true. Okay, and then 2008, very short order, you were in a wheelchair.
Yes. It was the time when I thought that I had finally reached like the top. We had moved to Berlin. I had a steady job too. I was working in a news agency, working shifts at the three kids, and I felt that I'd finally proven that I could have it all, you know, like the great career, you know, not the nitty-gritty freelancer stuff, but like the real career, real job, and the family. We lived in a beautiful house, and it was sort of the pinnacle. And I had been brought up in a very conservative climate and culturally conservative in Germany. The idea of a working mom when I was a teenager was very much frowned upon. It was like, you know, what do you want to have kids for if you want to go to work? And I had wanted to show that you can, yes, you can have it all. And that's how I felt. And I think I might have been a little bit stressed out with the shift work and the kids and everything, but I didn't realize that until one day I was picking up my kids from school and I was seeing double, like literally double. And that was super scary because you know, I was 45. You might have a niggle in your lower back or some, you know, some little pains and aches and stuff, and you can, you know, happily ignore and think, oh, that's going to go away. When you're seeing double, it's only one way. You have to go to the doctor, and they sent me to the hospital, and I spent 6 weeks there. And after 3 weeks, not only was I seeing double, but I had completely lost the use of my legs. It was like an ascending paralysis. They were not, the doctors were not sure what was going on because I had various symptoms. You know, they have their little boxes where when, like, you know, seeing double, that's a syndrome, whatever, Miller-Fisher. And, you know, the leg paralysis, that's a Guillain-Barré. So they couldn't make up their mind. And it makes you wish for a diagnosis. I mean, it was so sudden and so scary. And I wasn't sure. And nobody told me, oh, yeah, it's okay, you're going to walk again. Nobody said that. I don't think they were sure if I would. And you start wishing to, please tell me I have something. Tell me, you know, anything. Just give me some explanation. But it wasn't after I had left the hospital that they finally said they thought it was a Guillain-Barré, which is a one-off. So it was super scary. And the time in the hospital is, you know, it doesn't, I don't know how to say this. I can't imagine anybody getting out of hospital better than they went in. And I'm not talking about, you know, the particular condition or injury or disease that you have and that they treat you for, but like your overall state, because you lose your humanity in hospital. You have no autonomy. You have no power at all. You don't decide when the lights turned on in your room. You don't decide when you go to sleep. You don't just decide when you wake up. I couldn't walk. I couldn't decide when I wanted to go to the shower or to the toilet. So I felt like really totally like I lost my humanity or my dignity. And that's a scary and very, I'm not going to say traumatizing experience, but it's like a big shock, and it totally changes everything, your entire outlook on life. And it took me like 6 months. I came home in a wheelchair, then I walked with crutches, then I walked with one crutch, and then after 6 months I was okay. I got treatment for 2 years after that just to make sure that I kept getting better. And then after a while I was told that this was over, this was done. I had a normal health like everybody else. This was not going to come back. And I was, you know, so happy. I was so grateful. I called my husband and we cried on the phone, both of us, because it was like a second shot at life, right? And after a year, we moved again. And over the course of the next year, in November, December, I felt my left hand going numb. I knew from the sensation compared to what I had before that this was not good news. Went to the doctor again, and they said, this is a different animal. This is an attack of your immune system on the white matter in your nerves. And if that happens again, we're going to declare you an MS patient. I waited. I hoped that wouldn't come back. And it did come back like a year later. It was a super mild relapse. If I hadn't been doing a plow pose on the bedroom floor, I would not have noticed it, but there was a tingling in my spine and I knew it wasn't right. And so we nipped it in the bud. You get an infusion right away. So, you know, we controlled it, but the decision was there. You have MS and you're going to need lifelong treatment.
Well, first of all, I can only imagine, or no, I can't even imagine, put it that way. Like, just as you were talking about being in hospital, I was thinking about especially the woman that you were right at that moment where you really felt that you were at the pinnacle, and then suddenly, like, having every decision stripped away from you and not being able to do anything about it. You know, it's not like you could say, well, screw that, I'm going to have my shower now, anyways. You know, you were stuck, sort of thing. But the other thought that I had was, because I work a lot with our elderly and our frail elderly, is previous generations of women were used to being sort of just secondhand citizens, for lack of a better term. And so that sort of almost explains why they tolerate it, put up with it, expect it in hospital. I'm just, because, sorry, I deal with elderly people and I deal with people in hospital. And yeah, that really explains a lot. It's interesting just putting that process together in my head as you were
Yes,
speaking.
I think there's something, and this is part of the things that I tell every woman I talk to. If you're in touch with the medical profession, they do their best, but they have time limits, pressure on them. You must advocate for yourself, and you must ask all the questions. Ask until there's no question left. Don't think that they can decide for you everything that there is to decide. You get a say, but you have to raise your hand and say, "I want to say something."
Yeah. And I know in my own parents' generation, it was like, that's, he's the doctor, because it was a he, and he's all knowing, all seeing. So they wouldn't question us a single thing. So as much as I'm sure the medical profession hates Dr. Google, you can get a lot of information and at least go in somewhat educated when you're going in for something.
Yes, absolutely. And when the doctor told me you need lifelong treatment, I started asking questions. He was just sort of writing the prescription and wanted to send me on my way. And I said, "Hang on a moment. Come, can we talk about this? The second relapse, it was so mild. Do I really need treatment? Isn't that a sign that I'm getting better? And if we start treating this, we will never know if I'm getting better or not. Or is it maybe the treatment that keeps me from relapsing?" And he was not used to that, definitely. But he played along up to a point. There was a point after, after close to an hour, I think he got a little bit impatient because he really was not used to that at all. I really fought because, and I think that goes back to the stay in hospital, the way, lifelong treatment, depending on medication, and the medication is injecting yourself 3 times a week. It's another way of giving your power away. And there was everything inside me said, no, I don't want this. I don't want to give my power away. But they scare you, and they're not wrong. I'm not t saying he was wrong. They are just trying, to rein in that disease that has a million faces. Anything could happen, and that's the scary part. You don't know where you're going with this. So they're just doing what the protocol says about trying to keep that disease in check. So at the end of the hour, I had to give in, and I said, okay, I guess I'm going to have to do it.
You just clarified something. I think I was going to ask if, like, right now we're talking about Kim and MS, but does MS manifest itself differently in different bodies?
Absolutely. They really say it's a disease of I don't know how many thousand faces or something. It's because it's your immune system sort of making errors and attacking, your own body tissues. And MS is the one where the nerve cells are attacked, but it could be, the nerves that control your motor system. For me, it was always more sensitive. Like I didn't have sensitivity because the sensitive nerves were attacked. But it can also touch your visual system. You can could go blind, and it's really different for every single person, every single patient of this disease.
So where did you get to, or when did you get to the point where you said, I don't even know what you said, but you decided that intentional eating and weight training were going to be part of your life? What was that transition?
So at the end of the talk with the doctor, I asked, "Can I exercise?" Because I had been a gym goer, and I liked working out, and I felt this need to get my physical strength back. It's still related to this feeling so powerless and so weak in hospital, and also in the situation with the doctor where he tells me what to do and I'm going to need to inject myself 3 times a week for the rest of my life. I asked him, can I exercise? And he was very noncommittal, saying, yeah, but please be careful, which didn't mean anything at all. Like, is it a yes or is it a no? And because doctors, they don't have much training or education when it comes to exercise. And I think he felt that, yeah, exercise, everybody says it's okay, but who knows what she's going to do? I don't want to be responsible because I'm not sure. So he said, yeah, be careful. I was lucky because I talked to a nurse later who showed me how to inject myself. And she said, exercise is great because it makes your body fatigue resistant. And fatigue is a big thing in MS patients. And I took that as my green light. And I went to the gym. I armed myself with a book, one of the first books that said women should lift heavy. And I can't tell you how I put the pieces together. It's just, I think I just followed this urge, this desire to get like really strong. And I went to the gym with a different purpose. It was not about, staying in shape or achieving a certain body shape or, controlling your weight. I just wanted to build myself back up and become really strong. That was my only goal. So that's what I trained for with the help of this book, which was great. I started lifting heavier and heavier, and my whole outlook, my body changed, my outlook changed, everything changed. And my eating changed along with it, because when you get into this spirit of building instead of shrinking, instead of becoming smaller or following a certain aesthetic ideal, if you get into the spirit of building strength, what you have to eat sort of follows along automatically. You eat to nourish, you eat to build, which makes it super simple actually, and makes it so much easier also to follow, because it's not a diet, it's not a restrictive approach. It's just, what does my body actually need to perform, which feels great. And you feel great after every meal, when you get those foods that you know will help you get stronger.
Well, I can only imagine. I used to be uber fit, so I'm just grinning along here going, yeah. But like MS, it sounds like it's going to be MS. Like you don't know exactly. Whereas to be able to control this one piece of your life and feel strong and in control is a bit of a counterbalance that hopefully you're going to win on that, the scale. As for eating, when I would work out, I would save my grocery shopping for right after my workout, so that I was sort of feeling holier than thou, like I've just done all this, and so obviously I'm not going to buy that and that and that. So I love the word intentional. It's actually a word that I've recently adopted for a piece of my business that I'm developing. Tell us a bit more about intentional eating, Kim Rahirsau.
Yes, so it's, what do I want my meal to look like? And what do I want to feel like after I've eaten my meal? So I do not go into the meal passively, like, let's see what's going to happen. And this is very important because we often eat in social connection, in social settings where we feel that, if my mother-in-law made this pie, then I better eat it or she will be unhappy. So really not let things happen to you. And it happens a lot with eating and letting things happen. That could also be just your brain being, you're tired, you're sad, you're stressed out. So your brain is going to say, give me sugar. This is also where you let stuff happen to you if you're not intentional. If you're intentional, you say, what is my intention? I want to eat food that helps me perform and feel strong and energized. And I want to eat food that helps me feel satisfied, happy, and good after a meal. Not bloated or like totally overstuffed, but not hungry and dissatisfied either. So you have to really go, and this is the power aspect again. You go with intention into your meal. It's like you are building this. You are not suffering this. You are building this, and you make the decision. And you can even do so when you're in a restaurant or when you're invited. If you have something of a blueprint in your mind of what's best for you and your body, what works for you, you can be intentional in the choices that you make with things that are offered to you. So even when you're not the cook, you can be intentional with your eating.
Well, I found also that my lifestyle was so healthy that, as you say, the social side of it, or even just an impulse of like, I am doing so well, I'm being so good about everything. What the heck? I haven't had, whether it's a piece of pie or nachos or whatever, I haven't had them for months. So I'm going to splurge. And I would have something and I'd feel so bad. No, and I don't mean just, I'd feel awful. Like I'd feel sick. I'd feel just blah. And I remember that feeling of like, well, I guess I don't have to worry about those anymore.
Yes.
The choice was made for me because my body reacted so, I don't know, I think it's probably disappointed as well as a little bit angry that I put that into my face.
I think that's another aspect also of intentional, because when you have an episode like this and you're thinking, was this worth it? Most of the time you're going to say no. But when you're being intentional, you make that decision beforehand. You ask yourself, is this going to be worth it? And if you are making a conscious decision and you say, okay, I don't know, it's Easter Sunday and I want to have a handful of chocolate eggs because it's going to sort of help me with the spirit of Easter or childhood memories, whatever it is, if it is a conscious choice that you make intentionally and you ask yourself, do I really want this? And what do I want this food that I'm about to eat? What do I want it to do for me? And it doesn't always have to be, I want this food to build, super strong muscles and burn fat and do this and do that. If you are making an intentional, conscious choice and say, I just want this food to give me some comfort or some joy or, some childhood memory, whatever it is, and it's not something that is happening to you, but that you are choosing, it's fine. And you're going to feel much better afterwards. You're not going to feel like, you have sort of checked out, and then when you check back in again, the bag with the Easter eggs is gone or something. It's really you are in charge. It's again about attention and about you making the decision.
Yeah, I've known women on other programs, as I use air quotes, and the night before weigh-in, they're not eating a thing, and that sort of thing, or I don't just all the stigma behind weight and food, whereas as you say, you make one choice at a time, but you make the choice.
Yes.
You don't just sort of worry about an outcome that you don't even know what that outcome is going to be. Like, are you going to be down that 1 pound that you seem to think matters so much, or whatever the outcome is.
Yeah, absolutely. And making choices is crucial. And what you said is like really the thing, one choice at a time. Because we cannot make choices today for tomorrow. It's what happens with every single diet that the woman goes on this planet, and preferably on the 1st of January, you try, you have this 1st of January, this New Year's rush. Maybe you're even hungover from partying too hard, and you, now I'm going to make this choice. I'm going to, whatever, not eat sugar for 4 weeks. You cannot make a choice for the next 4 weeks in that situation. It's not possible because you do not know, where you are going to be. You have to focus on the next choice, just the next choice, and make that the best possible in the circumstances.
And hopefully you'll agree with me when I say, like even if you have that, instead of the six little baby Easter eggs, you have a seventh, you don't beat yourself up for it. It's like, okay, may have slipped a little bit there. Next choice will be better. You just keep on
Absolutely.
moving
This is
forward.
actually one of the cornerstones of my approach, which I call clean slate 24/7. So you, and this is, it's actually a skill that you can learn where, you don't go, oh my God, I've eaten seven Easter eggs, might as well now open the bag of nachos and then crack a bottle of wine open and whatever it is. You can wipe the clay, clean the slate clean.
Thank you.
You can wipe the slate clean at any point in time, even at 11 p.m. So I don't know, you've had a a bag of Haribos and you think before you go to bed you need to just push it further because you have really screwed your day anyway. And then, no, you can stop at 11, say, I'm going to have a glass of water, I'm going to go to bed. And when you develop that skill, you know, that's so powerful because you don't beat yourself up. You don't live in the past. And even if the past is like the choice that you made 2 hours ago, you know, you just brush it off. And you know, next choice is going to be a good one. And forgive yourself. For heaven's sake, forgive yourself. And don't go into, you know, don't make this into a character trait, a personality trait where, oh my God, I am so undisciplined. Oh my God, I can't control myself. Just, you know, assume, like own up to that choice. I made that choice, but now I'm going to make a different one. And that's it. There's, you know, nothing else going on. There's no ethical process there of being good or bad or, you know, like judging what you've done. No, you've made this choice. Right now you feel that maybe it wasn't the best choice you could have made in the moment. So let's make the next one just a little bit better.
As you're saying that, I was thinking, I wonder how many healthy lifestyles have been lost because somebody made that judgment, not about what they've just eaten, but they apply it to their whole being of, I am useless. I obviously can't do this. I can't even do, you know, I can't even turn down nachos. What's the point of trying? Because I just can't do it. Whereas one day at a time, one choice at a time.
Yes, absolutely. And I think there's a big, it's a big thing. It's something that I keep talking about because I think it's so important. Most of these things, when it comes to lifestyle, when it comes to intentional eating, when it comes to training, when it comes to looking after your health, especially in this day and age, they are skills. They are just skills that you can learn. Just imagine we live with this brain that's thousands and thousands of years old, and that is hardwired to want to eat all the time. That's just a fact. Every human being is hardwired to want to eat all the time. Now, there may be some outliers who hate food, but you know, in general, that's what's going on. Why? Because it has helped humanity survive. Food was always scarce. There was always a lack of food. There was always the danger of starving around the corner. So this has really been programmed into us. If there's food, we want to eat it because we don't know is there going to be food again, you know, tomorrow or for an entire week. Now, with this brain that we all have, we live in an environment where food is offered and pushed on us 24/7. How are we going to deal with this? So if you know, you see a donut, you want to eat the donut. And that's just, it's not because you're a bad person. It's not because you have no self-discipline. It's simply because you're human. What you need to do is develop the skill to deal with this, you know, hardwiring that we have and learn to interpret the signals that come from your brain that tell you you need to eat this, and you taking the time to step back and say, hang on a second, brain. Do I really need to eat this now? How am I feeling? Am I hungry? Am I maybe tired? Am I maybe sad? And it's a skill. You can learn it, and then you can deal with this 24/7 onslaught of food that we have these days.
I want to touch briefly on weight. And the story that I will preface this with is a coworker many years ago when I was uber fit and teaching. A coworker came and said, well, what should I do? I'm trying to, you know, like lose a bit of weight or something. So I said, well, you know, try this, try this, try this. And look, 3 weeks later, she comes to me and she said, well, that didn't work. And I went, oh, she said, I haven't lost a pound. And I said, oh, okay. I said, well, how are your slacks fitting? She said, oh, well, no, I've had to buy some new slacks because, you know, I'm leaner now, but the weight hasn't changed. And I'm going like, well, what's the most important thing? So what's it, can you give us your take on weight?
Absolutely. This relates to something that we call body composition. So the weight, you know, only tells half the story of your health and your body. Because you could be like super light, have like this ideal weight, but have a really high percentage of body fat, which would be rather unhealthy. And you could weigh much more, but carrying lots of lean muscle. and you'd be fighting fit and really super healthy metabolically. Your joints, your bones, even your mental health, everything is probably going to be better with that muscle. And this is also something where so many women have this number in their head, like, oh, this is what I weighed when I was 27. Some, and when they're older, sometimes it's, this is what I weighed when I was in my 40s and I felt so good. And I just want to get back to that weight again. When the number doesn't say anything, and if you have been on a lot of diets, the chances are that you've reduced your lean muscle mass. And no matter what you do, you won't be able to get to that weight except by starving yourself, by eating into your muscle mass and making it harder every time to keep that weight, because your metabolism just tanks when you destroy your muscle by harsh dieting. And the number, it's just a number. It doesn't say anything about your health. It's the same problem with the BMI, because it talks about the relation between your height and your weight. And just imagine, like, you're a very healthy weightlifter with a ton of muscle mass. Your BMI might actually be totally out of bounds. And a doctor, and I sometimes hear women saying, my doctor tells me I have to lose 20 pounds because of my BMI. And they are like super muscular and lean. And apparently, the doctor doesn't even look at them and just looks at the number and says, you know, you have to lose 20 pounds. No, you don't. If you carry a good amount of muscle, you're fine. And then the weight is just a secondary indicator.
Okay, so you've just talked about muscle. I've saved the best part for last. I was also ACE certified. I love the weight room. So I know why we should be doing the weights, but I want you to tell our listeners why it's so important for just overall health.
Absolutely. I want to start with something that I try to. I think our bodies are actually optimized to be moving a lot and to be physically like strong and muscular. And when I say optimized, I mean that they function best. Our bodies function best when we move a lot and when we, you know, break a sweat daily and carry stuff and push stuff and pull things and things like that. What do I mean by that? It's really important because many people have this image of their everyday life. And nowadays, that means, you know, driving a car, sitting at a desk, sitting at a table for meals, and then sitting in the sofa and watching some show. And then you think, oh, if I want to be a bit healthier, I should move. So I'm going to go for a walk. I'm going to go for, you know, some training. But that's not how it works. It's the other way around. If you do not have that baseline of movement and strength, your health is going to deteriorate. So we are optimized. Our bodies function best when we train and move a lot. And science has found this in so many ways now, especially when it comes to muscle. Muscle mass is important for cardiovascular health. Nothing but the contractions, like the really efficient contraction of your muscle will help your heart pump the blood through your body, which is great because, you know, it sort of relieves the heart. Isn't that great? It's fantastic for blood sugar management because the muscle is the first storage space of sugar in the bloodstream. So if you carry a decent amount of muscle, any carbs, any sugars that you eat will not hang around in your bloodstream and mess with your metabolism or your pancreas. They will just go straight to the muscles and be stored as an energy reserve. So that makes everything so much easier for your metabolism. Muscle is crucial for bone health because, you know, when you train for muscle, you load the bones and they stay strong, and we lose bone density at an alarming rate from 35 years onwards. As women, 35 is when we have our maximum. We're not going to have more ever. We're going to lose if we do not do everything in our power to maintain that. And bone health is, I don't know, I think one out of two women is going to have a fracture over the age of 60 at some point in her life, because the bone density goes down and because we do not have this baseline of movement and strength training now in our lives. Our bones just, you know, they wither away. We need to load them. Same goes for our joints, you know, which carry all the weight if we don't have enough muscle to sort of support them. And a very important point is also something that I call functional independence. You need strength I mean, to open a pickle jar, to lift a grandchild, to roll on the floor with your grandchild, or to get out of a sofa, you know, without pushing on your arms like crazy or needing help. So it's just to be able to partake in life and in society, you need that strength. And I think it's something that is getting more and more into the mainstream now, that you need those muscles, and that it's got nothing to do with pumping iron and being a bodybuilder. It's got much more to do with being able really to you know, to fool around with your grandchildren and to be able to take part in social life.
I love the way you said about the grandchild, because I will often use scenarios with people that I'm talking to. And one of the scenarios is, are you comfortable lifting that hefty 4-year-old grandson? You know, because if you're avoiding that, I mean, cuddles are great. So if you can lift them up and give them a big hug or something, that's just so fabulous. And when you have to avoid that because you just don't have the strength, there's, to me, it's kind of sad. I'm on the west coast of Canada, and it was only about a month and a half ago that we had a lot of snow. I was trying to go out into the backyard to feed the birds, and I have some steps, old wooden steps, and I went, okay, hang on to the rail because these are going to be icy. And I'm being so careful, but boom, I was gone. I went flying down the stairs, landed on the cement at the bottom. And I will admit, my first thought was, okay, checked things out, I'm fine. So I got up, fed the birds, and came back in very carefully. But just knowing that, okay, because of the work I've done, no fractured hip, you know, no broken legs or anything at all. So yeah, it's just, it pays dividends in so many ways as we get older.
Absolutely.
Now, how about sleeping?
Oh, sleeping. What do you mean? How
Well,
the
I just,
the
well,
importance of
just in
sleep?
terms of when you're healthy and everything's working well, you're not sort of lying there thinking, oh, I can't get comfortable, or oh, things ache, or
Oh,
whatever. Like, you sleep so much better.
absolutely. And that's a pretty rapid effect when you start training. You know, you will get this kind of, especially if you train in the morning for because of circadian rhythm, you will get this healthy tiredness in the evening, where, you know, where you feel like your brain is sort of calming down, unwinding, if you don't overstimulate it with stuff. And yes, your sleep will definitely be better and beneficial, and you will have much more production of growth hormone during your sleep if you don't drink alcohol, which will then repair all your tissues and build your muscle, and it becomes a virtuous cycle, and it creates momentum where you feel yourself getting better and feeling more confident every day.
The last thing I want to touch on about this immediate weight training is just the fact that, you know, a lot of women, you know, like, I don't want to get all bulky, I don't want to, you know, look muscle bound. But sorry, my training was a long, long time ago, so correct me if I'm wrong. But doesn't bulk come from greater amounts of testosterone in the body, which women do not have?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And even if you have the testosterone, like many men, go and watch them toiling away in the gym for years trying to build that bulk, and they're still not getting it. So for a woman, what makes you think it's, you know, some outliers, genetic outliers in women, they probably will build muscle very quickly, but they're like, you know, extremely few. Chances that this is you are as good as non-existent. And I sometimes get a little bit sort of upset with this stereotype, because it underestimates the hard work that goes into building muscle. I mean, like bulking, you know, you're going to have to work hours and hours and hours in the gym, and you have to do that for weeks and for months and for years. It's not like, you know, you look at a pink dumbbell from 2 yards and then it's going, you know, the muscle is just going to cling to your body. And then I want to ask something else. Why are you wondering, when you think about muscle and strength, why is your first concern the way you look? Why not think about, how is this going to make you feel? Because even if you bulk up and you feel, you know, like you're on top of the world and you can lift anything and you can stand your ground and you carry yourself confidently, would that not be like a really great reason to do this? Why do we first think about how is this going to make me look instead of how is this going to make me feel?
Two thoughts come to mind is I first got into fitness immediately after having three children in 3 years. So, I was starting from a very unfit, shall we say, still carrying baby fat. And I remember a few key moments where I was trying to sort of prep to do something because I knew it was going to be difficult. And it was just like a piece of cake because now I was fit and strong. And those things are like, we all have those where were you when? It's burned into my memory that feeling of almost elation of like, oh my God, I can't believe I just did that. Just crazy. But the other thought you were talking about how you look and things like that. Definition, muscle definition is a fabulous thing. And I mean, I'm trying to figure out how to phrase this here because it's sort of a sexist thing to say. But I said after I got my fitness training certificate and stuff like that, and I knew quite a bit about muscles. I said that the trouble with being at this stage and having these credentials is the fact that I will never look at a man's body again and say, oh, nice, sorry, this is really sexist. Oh, nice butt. It's like, oh, there's some definition in there. So to have definition is, I think, a beautiful thing.
I love that look, and it's not muscle that makes you look bulky. It's fat that makes you look bulky. That's just a fact, and I think muscular bulk is the last thing you need to worry about as a woman.
Okay, so into a scenario here. Many mid-age women have slowed down. They've had some weight gain. They have some aches and pains. I was going to ask where they start to reconnect with their former strong selves, but I know a lot of women who my age who've never been really strong. Let's talk about them. Like, how do they begin this journey?
Yes, it's totally possible. You can begin at any time. You could even begin when you're like 95 and you've never done anything. Your body will still react in the same way. But you do need a reconnection, and not, like you said, to your former strong self, but you do need a reconnection between your brain and your muscles, because our body is very pragmatic and very ruthless. So if you don't push, pull, carry, lift, and this doesn't have to be in the gym, it's like in your everyday life. If you don't use those muscles, your brain is going to put them kind of offline. It's going to say, okay, the connection, sending that signal to the muscle to contract, and this connection, having it sort of ready to go, is energy costly. And if I'm not needing this, and I'm not needing this for years and sometimes decades, the brain's going to put that connection offline. So when you actually want to start doing something, you realize that your brain can't actually command your glutes, your butt muscles, to contract. It's just lost. We call it gluteal amnesia. Now, the good news is it doesn't take long to wake that connection back up. And this is something that many people don't know. The expression of strength, like, muscle contraction, what you can lift, how strong you are, is to a very great part just the result of the quality of the connection between your brain and your muscle fibers, and the quality of the signal that the brain sends to the muscles. So when you, for example, train to muscular failure and you can't do the contraction anymore, like to let it be a bicep curl, and you cannot just curl the weight up anymore, it's not the muscle that's failing. It's the signal that doesn't get sent fast enough and cannot, it's the central nervous system tiring out. Not being able to send that signal. So this is crucial. If you have never done anything, you want to gently awaken that connection. So don't go off and start doing HIIT training or try to do push-ups or whatever it is. You need a gentle reactivation and reconnection. And once you have put that in place, the sky's the limit. You can progress from there, but you want to lay that foundation of where your brain and your muscles are connected. You don't need to go to a gym for that. You can do that at home. You have to do a certain type of exercise to make that happen. It's very gentle, and you'll feel different. You feel that renewed connection because you'll feel connected to your body, which will give you so much confidence and a different way of carrying yourself.
I actually have this written in my notes because I heard it or read it somewhere on your website. Retrain your brain to reconnect with your muscles. And so thank you for explaining that because it's an interesting concept that your brain's just going to sort of say, okay, that obviously that muscle doesn't exist anymore because they never use it.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is another part of this story of survival of humanity, to be economical with our energy. And it's just a way of saving energy again for the brain. In the brain, it's all about allocation of resources. And if you don't ask for those by training, and they're not going to be allocated. But you can awaken that, and it will make a big, big difference.
Now, I saw some, I guess, testimonials on your website from women 69, 70, 74. So obviously, as you said, it's never too late to do this sort of thing. Somebody said like 5 minutes a day to start. Is that a good thing or a right thing?
I love the 5-minute rule. It's something, if you, especially if you start and you have inner resistance to change because it's scary, it's intimidating, it's uncomfortable. If you can get yourself to do 5 minutes, that's fine. What I start my clients with is 15 minutes a day, which gives them, results super quick. I know it sounds like such a big promise, but it really works. 15 minutes a day is enough to start doing those basic movements that the human body does, like pulling, carrying, picking stuff up from the floor, getting stuff down from overhead. You can go through these movements in 15 minutes, and it will provide a stimulus that will change everything. You just need to start, and this is crucial. You need to start where you are at. I think that's a really important point because depending on how offline your muscles are or how limited your mobility has become, how much your strength is reduced, you just need to start at a point that is, where the exercise is challenging enough, but it's not overwhelming you, discouraging you, or, even injuring you. That's the problem for many midlife women. They look for a program and you can find fantastic stuff on YouTube, but it's not for someone who hasn't exercised in a long time. And it's very easy to get hurt, especially if you try then to contract those muscles that are offline and you're going to do a movement that can get yourself hurt. So you can start anytime, but you need to start, with your physical status in mind.
I actually still lead a seniors fitness class, and these women are mostly in their 80s and 90s now. And they love to talk about the improvements in their balance, their range of motion, their flexibility, as time goes by. And, as we get older, it's just so important because we tend to operate in this little face forward, very little to the side, let alone to the back. And balance goes out the window as well because we never really push it. But yeah, it's I feel like we're two members of the same choir.
Yeah, absolutely. Yes. There's one thing also that we need to consider and that I do with all my clients, and that is, I mean, it's called fall prevention, but it's actually fall reaction training. So you need to do movements where you put your body in weird positions for your brain to learn, how to move the body, how to deal with the body when it is in a weird position, which happens when you fall. And then have protective reflexes. I don't know if you see and have ever seen an old person fall. Mostly they fall like a sack of potatoes because the reflexes are completely gone. And you can train for that. And you don't have to do fall training or anything like a judo guy, but you to teach your brain to perceive your body in horizontal positions, in weird positions. Because then it will be used to this kind of setting. And when you take a tumble, it will have the reflexes to make some protective moves and prevent major damage.
I'm enjoying this. Thank you. Is there anything we haven't talked about that you think mid-age women should know?
I think the most important part is, first of all, to understand that it's never too late, because that's something many mid-age women struggle with, thinking, oh my God, it's so many years, so many decades. I've looked after everybody. And now, when I'm reminded by my body that there was something else to look after, it's too late. It's never too late. And I also really want to emphasize that I don't know why. I think it's deeply human, but we have this these feelings of guilt and shame that come with feeling unable to function properly, or when st things start going wrong with our body, we somehow think it's our fault. We have been bad, and shame and guilt come with this. For many women, shame and guilt go with the weight also, and that's really toxic. And I would just encourage everyone to let go of that shame and that guilt. Wherever you are at today, you are there for a reason. You made choices, and it doesn't mean that they were bad choices. You looked after so many things, so many people. You made that choice to help other people, to be there for them. And if you or your body or your health has suffered in the process, it doesn't mean that they were bad choices. Just be aware that you can make new choices today, like the next choice that you're going to make is the one that is essential. And let go of these feelings of shame or guilt or thinking that you've done something wrong, because that's just sort of living in the past. And what you want to do is live in the now and do what you can now to feel better and to enjoy life to the fullest.
Great. One more question, slightly different vein, perhaps. You also talk about resilience. Can a person become more resilient, or is it a you are or you aren't kind of thing?
I think, yes, you can become more resilient. Like the other things that I mentioned before, I actually think it's a skill. I have this, let me first tell you why I came up with this image that I'm going to share in a while. I once talked to a woman, and it was the first time that I heard the story, and it was repeated to me many times by other women. Said, oh, like 10 years ago, I worked with a PT. I was in the best shape of my life. I ate well. I trained 3 times a week. I felt fantastic. And I said, and then what happened? Well, the PT, they moved away. And then I stopped. And I've heard this story, I swear to God, more than once, many times. And I started thinking, how can we prevent this? And it's actually when your system, your support system, your health depend on just one point. Like I see it like a net, like a safety net. Resilience is a safety net. And if it depends on just one knot in the net and that knot breaks, you fall through. You cannot, and this is the image with resilience, like you bounce back, right? To bounce back, you need an entire net. So build more knots to have a big net of support. So if you're going to train in the gym, make sure you're not dependent on one PT. Maybe find yourself some gym buddies or do classes too. When it comes to food, do not rely on a particular eating style or I don't know, supermarket or one person to cook all the meals. We have many, many points of support. Build that net, that safety net for you. So when one knot breaks, all the other knots are there to catch you and help you bounce back so you can rebuild that broken knot and make your system whole again. It's a skill. You can learn it. And it's, not that there's something wrong with you if you don't have that net, but you have to work on it and make it a reality.
I love that analogy. That's great. I think I'll be using that one. Okay, so you actually have a business training, and you do that by Zoom sometimes for the distance people. Is that correct?
Yes, I work exclusively online with women. I think, I use a coaching app, and I think you actually have a better connection, a tighter connection, a closer connection online because you can be in touch 24/7. I mean, I do sleep, but my clients can message me anytime. They are never stuck. They always know exactly what to do next. And if they don't, they can ask me, and they're never alone. That's the beauty of online. When you work with a PT, you see them, when you can afford it, you work with them 3 times a week, but that's 3 hours, right? And all the other hours in the week, I think there's like then 165 more left, probably wrong number, but you get the gist. You're on your own. Whereas online, you get like real ongoing support, which is great. And the exercise sequences come in videos that you can follow. It really works pretty well. And also it enables me to work with women all over the world, which I love.
Oh, that's great. Now, you also have a health and strength assessment. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, that's on my website and it's actually free. So you can take that and find out, what is your status right now? This point where you're at, your starting point, the crucial information that you need, you don't need to know where you are. If you want to go from point A to point B, first, what's my point A? And on my website, which is kimrahir.com, you can take that free assessment. And it's not only about strength, like, can you do five push-ups, but it's like an holistic picture of your like physical and motivational status and where would be the best place for you to start or take steps.
I really appreciate how you phrase that because any starting point is only a starting point. It's not a judgment.
Absolutely. And I think this is something we still need to learn, especially as women, even the number on the scale, everything is just data. And data are there for us to interpret and then draw conclusions. And if we want a certain type of data as an outcome, we just rely on what we have now. Then we tweak, we change our approach, we do what we can to get the outcome that we want. But take all sort of moral, judgmental things out of this. It's just data. And that's, what I tell my clients about the weight also, Did they have a really stressful week or eat salty food? Then, well, the weight goes up. It doesn't mean that they messed up, doesn't mean that they've been bad. It's just data. And I think that's really a big shift that makes everything easier.
I think you and I are sisters from another mother. This is so good. So kimrahir.com is your website, and you're on social too, aren't you?
Yes, you can. I'm mostly on Facebook. I mean, I have an Instagram account, but on Facebook, I share my weightlifting adventures, free trainings, lots of tips, lots of fun. I try to make it entertaining and useful. And you can follow me just with my name, Kim Ra, here, and find out a bit more about what I'm up to.
Oh, that's great. May I ask you a personal question before we close?
Of course.
Opera?
Yes. I love opera. I must have seen the, oh my God, I can't remember how you call it in English. Like Figaro's Wedding? No, it's not called that. They're not Zé de Figaro. It's a Mozart opera about Figaro. I've seen it, in a theater at least six times. Every time at the last scene, I sit there crying, crying because the music transmits the beauty of forgiveness. I'm gonna cry now because I love that so much. And I also take singing classes, full disclosure, and I've been taking singing classes for years and years. I just love opera.
Now, opera is a really wide group of styles. Is there a specific type of opera that you love more than anything?
Yeah, it's definitely Mozart. Anything by Mozart is going to take my fancy. And I don't know how such a young guy could express such a depth and variety of emotions in music. I mean, stuff he wouldn't even have experienced it normally, but it's all there. It's also funny, it's entertaining, it's beautiful. And some people say, oh, yeah, maybe I find it a bit boring. And then I don't know. I'm no expert. I don't know if this was a good opera or not. And I always say, you go there. And if you laugh or if you cry, then it was well done.
Well, correct me if I'm wrong too, but so often, even when it's in another language, it is so expressive that you know what's going on. You know the emotion. And as you say, I don't know if you speak Italian or not, but to be crying at the end of it, just from the emotion of
Yeah,
what's gone on.
it means you got your money's worth. And now, they have subtitles now. So you can, in the opera houses, though, you can actually read And you will find out that most areas, they are not like long, long poems or anything. It's a few phrases and they're repeated over and over again. And you just want to sort of dive into the emotion of it.
I gotta say, I love the look on your face after I said emotion or opera. Okay, that's great. Your website link is in the show notes, and all of the links are on your page at our website. Listeners, if you have thoughts on today's show, please talk to us. Leave comments where you're listening, or if you're listening at the Boomer Woman's podcast at boomwithabang.com, scroll to the bottom of the page and talk to us there. Or, what question did I not ask him? Ask it in the comments and I'll get you an answer. Leave stars and reviews where you can, they grow our reach. And share this episode. If you're fit and strong, share it with someone who might be struggling. If you're the one who's struggling, share it with a friend who can support you. We just talked about, or Kim just talked about her analogy of the net. You know, perhaps you can support each other so you age with strength and health. There's a bet out there, apparently, that the first person who will live to 150 is already alive. Maybe it'll be us. Kim, we're here. Thank you for being my guest today and being so open about your own story and assuring us we can be strong and healthy into our elder years.
Thank you so much for having me, and thanks for all the work that you do.
Well, have a great rest of week.
Thank you.